may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Paul Wall. I'm the court-appointed attorney representing Orlando Cruz this morning. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
We're here on a single assignment of error that this court granted with respect to the defendant's conviction under 18.2.137 subsection B. We have alleged that the trial court did not have sufficient evidence to convict him on that statute. In examining this case, we had set forth for the consideration of the trial court the Scott case, Scott versus Commonwealth, decided in 2011, and I believe some of you may have been sitting on that case. We believe that that case undertook a statutory construction of the revision to 18.2.137B and set forth a mens rea requirement that was different from the garden variety specific intent requirement. They undertook a rather thorough examination of that. I don't believe any other court has undertaken such an evaluation since that point, and I don't believe it has reached this level of court. So I believe that the standard would be that you could re-examine that and decide de novo whether or not the Court of Appeals' prior decision with respect to this was correct. In examining that, the Court of Appeals in the Scott case made clear that when the legislature revised the statute, they had separated apart the two types of mens rea that would be considered in destruction of property cases. One which led to a misdemeanor conviction would be basically requiring unlawful activity on the part of the defendant, and that a felony conviction required more than just general specific intent, as felonies normally do. It would require that...
You keep talking about general specific intent versus specific intent. Can you explain the distinction to me?
Distinction. All right. In Criminal Law 101, where we learned that the felonies are required to have a specific intent behind them as part of the mens rea. A lesser intent assigned to cases would be a case of general intent. And general intent, as the court has previously said, that it's a volitional thing where if there's a statement, if there's evidence to show that the defendant intended the ordinary consequences of his actions, that would be sufficient. When we get to specific intent in felony cases, what we're looking at is a specific intent to commit the type of crime. Felonies have to be accompanied by animus furandi or...
But you're saying that issue is before this court as to whether or not the Court of Appeals' interpretation of the statute was correct?
The decision of the Court of Appeals, based on what they've said about the trial court, was that the evidence was sufficient using the standard that the trial court used.
Which was specific intent, according to the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, according to the Court of Appeals, yes.
But is there an assignment of error on that issue?
Well, it's included in the sufficiency of the evidence. If you're testing the sufficiency of the evidence, you have to have a standard against which you're testing it. And it is laid out in the briefs that standard we believe is found in the Scott case that was presented to the trial court. And that standard would be that there had to be something more than the usual garden variety specific intent of a felony. And that intent had to be not just that the defendant intended his actions, but that he had specifically focused upon some aspect, some property that he intended to damage. And in this case, we're looking at best criminal negligence as found by the court in another one of the charges in the case. And criminal negligence doesn't rise to the level of the intent that the Scott case required.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Are you saying that the natural and probable consequence inference as a matter of law is inapplicable to specific intent charges?
No, to this statute.
So this statute is like uber specific?
Yes, intent? I think that when the legislature included the word intentionally, it didn't need to include that word. and when it revised it, as Scott laid out in his thorough analysis.
So if this were just a mere specific intent crime,
correct,
you would be able to use the natural and probable consequence inference, and unless it's irrational to make that inferential leap, there would be enough evidence to see here that he would be within a rational fact finder's scope of decision-making authority, guilty. But what you're saying is you need more than that. Am I mischaracterizing what you're saying?
I'm saying that you need more than that.
Well, where does the law say that?
The law, Scott's decision specifically says that.
You're talking about the Court of Appeals decision?
Yes.
Well, we're in the Supreme Court today.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's what I'm suggesting here, is that the Court of Appeals made its decision that nothing ever transpired that apparently was not appealed. This court has not considered the issue at all. And I think the court is free to consider that issue. I think the Court of Appeals is persuasive, perhaps.
Don't let me put words in your mouth, but let me make sure I understood our colloquy.
Sure.
You got general intent, right?
Sure.
You have general intent crimes. You have specific intent crimes.
Correct.
Your argument is that this statute under Scott is something at a level and a gradation higher than specific intent.
It includes another element.
Okay.
On specific intent, which would be akin to a premeditation.
Okay, but if it were not that, if you were wrong on that higher third tier of intent and it's just a mere specific intent crime, like most felonies, you're not challenging sufficiency in that middle category, but only in the upper category.
Well, I'm not going to necessarily concede that point. If the court, this court determines that it's just a garden variety specific intent felony, I still think that the evidence that was developed at the trial court level was not sufficient to show that, because,
But we can use the juries and trial judges can use the natural probable consequence inference in specific intent crimes, that middle category under your...
The middle category, I would concede that has been the law.
Okay.
But I thought your position, in essence, is that what the Court of Appeals said in Scott is what you believe the law should be regarding specific intent applicability to this particular statute.
Yes, the analysis that the Scott court did on the statute after it was revised is the correct analysis. And that analysis is that it is something more than just garden variety specific intent.
Even though, you know, from my reading of Scott, that's not what the court said. They didn't make this this distinction between garden variety specific intent and specific intent.
Well,
they just talked about specific intent.
They talked about specific intent, but if I can...
I mean, as opposed to us getting into that, the bottom line is you think that Scott is correct.
I think that Scott was correctly decided. I think that the analysis there is correct. This is a statute that was not... This was a crime not known in common law. We have to look to the statute to find out what the elements are of that crime. The legislature set forth those elements. They included a specific term intentionally.
And so my understanding is you're urging us to accept that standard, and you believe in this particular instance the evidence was insufficient.
Yes.
To meet that standard, and therefore your client
that's
charge
correct.
Should
that
be
is, that's correctly what I'm saying.
Well,
our conviction should be reversed.
Let me follow up on a prior question that I had.
Sure.
The Court of Appeals held that specific intent was required.
Yes.
Yes, okay. And the Court of Appeals held that the...
And you're talking about in the Scott case? Or
no, in this case.
In this case.
In this case. The Court of Appeals held specific intent was the test and that the evidence was... The trial court did not err. The evidence was sufficient to find specific intent.
Correct.
As I hear you this morning, you are really saying that the Court of Appeals erred because they didn't use the right specific intent interpretation, application. Is that correct?
Well, when you challenge the sufficiency of the evidence, you're doing two things. You're saying, all right, this is what the standard is for that particular element that you're challenging, whatever it is, mens rea, actus reus, whatever it is. And then we look at how the trial court, or in the case here, the Court of Appeals, analyze that based on what the trial record said.
But excuse me, when you challenge the sufficiency of the evidence, you say there was not sufficient evidence to meet the standards which were applied, which should be applied. That's different than saying the court erred because it applied the wrong standard. And there's no assignment of error with regard to that. Is that correct?
The way you're stating it, you're correct. But I'm saying that the when you challenge sufficiency, you're challenging two things. You're challenging what is the law, and did the did whatever was developed in the trial court, or in this case the Court of Appeals analyzing what the trial court did, that's there are two parts of the same thing. It's a mixed question of fact and law. There's really no way to separate one from the other if you're discussing it. And our brief made that very clear. I think that the briefs and the petitions and the briefs that we did for the trial court all set forth those same elements and explained that we didn't believe that the court applied the correct law or made
so
the correct decision.
Let's reframe that last. So your argument is they applied the wrong specific intent standard. They should have applied the third grade, the third level that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
As was done in their previous case.
Whose previous
Scott.
Case?
Scott!
Scott in
yes.
the previous case, yes.
So,
I'm sorry, I didn't realize which one you were referring to.
So of the at the higher grade is your interpretation of Scott, and there's really no assignment of error on that point, but then you go into applying the higher grade of a specific intent, which does not allow the natural probable consequences inference generally under your theory, then the evidence falls. Is that a fair or do you think that's an unfair caricature of your position?
It's a partially correct characterization.
Add whatever needs to be
well,
added.
I will return to it. It's a mixed question. The question was presented to the trial court. The Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court, although left out some of the parts that the trial court had referenced, and said that they would prefer to pursue a decision under the Knight case rather than under the Scott case.
So is it your argument today that they used the wrong legal standard for intent?
In addition to applying not only the wrong legal standard, but the evidence that was there was insufficient for it.
Okay. For the wrong legal standard. I mean, it was insufficient for the Cooper standard.
Correct.
Right. And I understand you rely on the word necessary in your assignment of error to get you there.
So yes.
To possess the necessary specific intent, you rely on that for having preserved that question.
Yes, I think that's why that is an assignment of error. I have now gone under my time, and this is correct.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Anderson for the Commonwealth. I think that the scope of the assignment of error ties in with these questions we've had about specific intent. The assignment of error, which I think the Court of Appeals certainly understood this, simply in a fairly routine manner asserted that the evidence was insufficient to support the felony destruction of property conviction under 182-137. Court of Appeals concluded that it was sufficient under some of the well-established principles for discerning intent, such as you may infer that you intend the natural, probable, and ordinary consequences of your actions. There are other ways that this court and the Court of Appeals have put it, but they all are essentially along those lines. Now, I took the assignment of error in the brief to challenge only the facts. There was no suggestion that the standard of review was incorrect. For example, if somebody for some reason didn't employ guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, but clear and convincing evidence, you would need in an assignment of error in some fashion to point out that the wrong standard had been employed. There was no assertion in this case at trial or in the Court of Appeals of such, in the assignment of error in particular, that such a wrong assignment of error was set forth. I'd also point out...
Mr. Anderson, I pointed out that word necessary not because I think it is sufficient, but because I think that's what he relies on. So you may be absolutely correct.
Your Honor, my understanding from the record is, and today counsel's talked about some kind of two-step specific intent. My understanding of his argument, in the trial court, was you have general intent and you have specific intent, and you don't have two gradations of specific intent. I think that was his argument in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals certainly gave no indication of some understanding of two levels of specific intent.
And that appeared to be the argument in the brief, too, from my recollection.
Yes, sir. I would note parenthetically that in his petition for appeal to this court, which was, for the most part, turned down, that he did say that the Court of Appeals had misapprehended his argument in that court in some manner. If he had regarded the Court of Appeals' treatment of his specific intent argument as somehow incomplete, he could have done the same thing in the petition for appeal in this court. I'm not aware, for what it's worth, of two levels of specific intent. The distinction has always been between general intent and specific intent, rather than, I think he even referred to this intermediate specific intent. I'm just simply not aware of that.
His understanding is Scott created a third tier, uber specific intent, and that the Court of Appeals violated his interpretation of Scott. I think that's what he said this morning.
My understanding of Scott, I hope I'm right, is because there had been a prior case, Nunes, unpublished decision of the Court of Appeals, that said that it was a general intent crime and that the evidence was sufficient. So when we got to Scott, the Court of Appeals went through this legislative analysis of the change to Section 18.2-137, from which it concluded that for the misdemeanor, it was still general intent, because it talked about unlawfully. But for the felony version, it was, I think it used the word intentionally, and it was a specific intent crime. So the argument from that he made in the trial court was, as per Scott, you had to prove specific intent in this case, and the facts were lacking to that point. In fact, at the very outset of his brief, he presented this case in a pretty straightforward and, I thought, correct way. This is at page 13 of his brief. He says, while the evidence presented at trial is sufficient to show the defendant negligently, that is a word emphasized, destroyed the property of another whose value was in excess of $1,000, which had been stipulated at trial, the value, there was no evidence to support the contention that the defendant intentionally, again, his word emphasized, destroyed the property in question. And I certainly have understood throughout the case that's been his argument, that it was enough to show negligence, but not enough to get you to the point of what would be deemed specific intent. And that's what I understood to be the focal point here, the issue that would decide this case up or down. And the argument
why is the evidence sufficient under the natural probable consequences of your action inference? And could a rational fact finder have come to that conclusion? What facts would
Yes, sir. I think probably the two most important witnesses were the eyewitnesses. One of them is literally an eyewitness to the fatal crash. The other is an eyewitness to everything but that. And I, in particular, Ricky Rutherford, his testimony is, it's not that long, but it's very significant. And it starts, let me see if I can find my little flag. I have too many flags, I think. It is, he, Oh, here it is, sorry. He had pulled off the road, and this is apparently just outside Culpeper, and I think this is somewhat pertinent. This is not apparently in the town limits, but the two eyewitnesses described going by McDonald's, going towards a skating rink. They mentioned a school, a high school, and apparently the fatal crash occurred not far from there, so it may not be in the heart of Culpeper, but on the other hand, it certainly is not 50 miles away where there's very little traffic or people. But Ricky Rutherford, this is at page 377 of the appendix, that he pulled over, getting out of his truck, he was on the telephone, he heard wheels screeching and turning, and then getting ready to race or something. Then he witnessed this green Jeep Cherokee, which is the car driven by the defendant Cruz, go flying down the road. And when I say flying down the road, I'm saying that he's on both sides of the road, swerving the whole way. Page 378, he also repeats he was swerving on both sides of the road, over halfway on both sides. Not insignificantly, he described this as a nice sunny day. It was perfect. So, and it was during the day, so the weather is not in any way a contributing factor. He then, because he follows the Jeep, he sees the Jeep barrel through a red light, no stopping, no nothing. He calls 911, and he said, I told her somebody's going to get hurt. He's going to hit somebody. And then he, because the Jeep is driving in this dangerous manner, he follows him. He actually sees the crash on this two-lane highway, which, again, is apparently shortly out of town. The Jeep's going northbound. The decedent's car is coming southbound, and he says that the Jeep goes into the northbound lane, and that the driver of the van who was killed, there was nowhere for her to go. She couldn't do anything. And she suffered fatal injuries. Her unborn child also was not born. And for immediate purposes, more than $1,000 of damage was done to the property.
So if the inference that you can be presumed to intend the natural, probable, and ordinary consequences of your action apply to this tier of specific intent, we have an eyewitness calling 911 and predicting exactly the consequence from the observations made contemporaneous with the driving.
Right, and Justice Kelsey, we not only have that witness, we have another witness, I think her name is Michelle White, and she gives comparable testimony. The one thing she doesn't say is, I literally witnessed the fatal crash, but she came upon it seconds afterwards. She describes the defendant as driving in a very dangerous manner, in fact, to the point that she pulled over to a deceleration lane so he could pass her. And even then, she was afraid he was going to hit her, that he was going to sideswipe her, even in the deceleration lane. And she said she was all the way off the main road. She, like Ricky Rutherford, I think this is very telling, she almost immediately calls 911 or the dispatcher to say, I've seen this, somebody's going to get hurt. So you have two different people within seconds of each other witnessing this driving and saying this could be a calamity. There's also another bit of important evidence, physical evidence, at the scene. Now, Ricky Rutherford, with his own eyes, saw, according to his testimony, the defendant's Jeep go into the other lane, leaving the driver of the van no way out. When an officer went to the scene of the crime that night and then the next morning, he detected no skid marks on the defendant's side, detected no yaw marks. He referred to shading, which is some indication of an attempt to brake, but it was on the van side, the side of the soon-to-be fatally injured person. So there's no evidence here, whatever, that the defendant ever made the slightest effort to stop as he came into the wrong lane. I would point out, by the way, in the later Knight case of the Court of Appeals, which is another one that's been discussed on brief, the dissent in that case was a very close case on the merits, but it pointed out and relied upon the fact that there was evidence that the defendant in that case, in fact, just before he collided with several cars, had braked. Here the evidence is just the opposite. No braking whatever.
What about in the Knight case, the reliance, it seemed to me, by the majority on the fact that Knight was not drinking, was sober?
Right.
As opposed to this case where this person was intoxicated.
Right, that's true. I would make a couple of points in response to that. Clearly, this man was intoxicated. I mean, the court's already affirmed two convictions that have DUIs and elements, so there's no question about that. Plus, the evidence otherwise pretty much unmistakably shows that. But the two things that occur to me to point out are, one, you know, intoxication is an element to the premeditation element of murder, but there are plenty of state cases saying it's not a defense to anything else, such as destruction of property. I also think it's interesting, and I'm not positive, but I seem to recall that because there were a lot of arguments here in this case, that the defense counsel at one point talked about, in responding to whether there was a DUI, pointed out that the defendant had in fact stopped, according to the two witnesses, particularly White, had stopped at a couple of traffic lights, which suggests that even if he was intoxicated, he was just not completely rendered senseless, that there was some element of control that he was able to manifest, although obviously it wasn't nearly enough to...
Counsel, is it your position that someone who is under the influence and really highly, very drunk and driving still has the capacity to make a volitional act, an intentional act, or even if there were unintended consequences? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Justice Lacey, particularly as it relates to a non-murder charge. The murder charge, capital murder, first-degree murder, whether it's premeditation, intoxication becomes a more significant issue to be resolved, but this is destruction of property. And again, the fact that the defendant was able to stop at a couple of lights suggests something other than just complete insensibility. One other quick point. Suppose the defendant had when he sideswiped White, had actually hit her car. That presumably would be the property damage, and 2 minutes later, that had not evaporated. Thank you.
I have a question for you, Mr. Anderson.
Yes, sir.
It's your position that the Commonwealth proves specific intent in this particular instance?
Yes, sir.
What about the concession by the Commonwealth's attorney at trial that he did not prove specific intent?
Well, that's an interesting point. I read these pages several times, and there's no question he says that at one point, but then he talks at several other points about specific intent. It's easy for me to say this in Richmond X number of months later. The argument, to me, seems muddled. But the more important thing for your purposes is, what did the court do? If he got it wrong, the court basically ignored him and used the right standard, that's what would be the controlling circumstance here. I think the judge's remarks, both on the denying the motion to strike, and then it later made factual findings. I think there are a number of references to specific intent as the element that it was finding. Again, there's no assignment of error that the wrong standard was used. Plus, the judge, of course, is presumed to know the law and apply it properly as a general proposition. Plus, ambiguity as to what the judge's thinking was is normally resolved in favor of the appellee.
Can the appellee concede the law in any event?
Excuse me, no.
Can the appellee concede law?
No, sir.
So we still have to review it de novo if it's properly presented in the assignment of error.
And I think that ties in, Justice Kelsey, with the notion that it's the judge's reasoning that ultimately, I mean, if the Commonwealth's attorney just had the most beautiful cogent recitation of the law, and the judge says, well,
and they conceded, and they conceded a fact.
Well, yeah, facts are different. But I think if you look at the judge's rulings in their entirety, given the several presumptions I've mentioned, I think it is sufficient to show that she found some evidence demonstrating specific intent.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
First, I would like to address Justice Kelsey's questions. If you look in the Scott decision at 707 Southeast 2nd, page 25, it says, when we consider the canons of statutory construction, we conclude that section 18.2.137b attaches criminal liability when a person performs a volitional act that damages the property of another. And, italicized, the person specifically intends to cause damage to the property by that act. This is contrary to the Commonwealth attorney's the Commonwealth's argument in that case. That's setting forth a different type of mens rea, because it adds an element. They actually do state it right in the opinion, that extra element of having to specifically intend to destroy
I get where you're getting that from Scott. Knight is in tension with that, of course, but let me repeat a question, make sure it's the third time I've asked this, so I don't want to put this to you without you thinking it through. Are you saying that the natural, probable, common, predictable, ordinary consequence jury instruction inference, as a matter of law, could not be given in this case or could not be considered by the bench trial judge? Because we have two eyewitnesses that actually contemporaneously predicted the very consequence that happened, so it couldn't be irrational for a fact finder to conclude, well, obviously the defendant knew it as well.
I don't believe that a jury instruction such as you stated would be an accurate reflection of this. It would also have to add and intended and the person specifically intends to cause damage to the property.
So that's where you're getting that third tier of mens rea.
I don't like characterizing it as a third tier of intent, but it is a mens rea with a...
Did the Court of Appeals put that in context, counsel, in footnote 10 when they said because of this finding, and they're saying the court found him criminally negligent, and that's why its finding could not stand, they reference, because of this finding, we leave for another day the question of whether an unintended consequence can be so probable and foreseeable as to be deemed intentional under the statute.
And we actually may be there today. You are correct. So, and I realize I've exceeded my time. I also did not include in this brief, sometimes I believe that we should make mention of this, is the impact that this would have. If you decide that it is the standard as suggested in the other cases and not in the Scott case, almost every traffic accident that happens out on the roads of the Commonwealth will suddenly become felonies and will have to be investigated as such. I thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for your argument. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All right.